Hi, today's December 16, 2017. This is Mobile Views Podcast 235. I'm Todd Agassawar, my good friend John Westfall. Kind of a bunch of mishmash items today. I won't say big topics. There's actually a couple of big topics. There's one especially I want to get John's take on, but we'll get to that kind of in the middle of the podcast. Bunch of googly stuff first. The one that has been killing my productivity for the last couple of days is Google's AR stickers, which is not an app. It is a feature built into the camera app of the recently updated Google OS 8.1, codenamed Oreo. So if you have a, and I don't know if it only works on Pixel phones, might be. If you have a Google Oreo, 8.1, there's also 8.0, but 8.1 turns on the dedicated hardware for image processing in the Pixel 2 and Pixel 2 XL. And I wonder if this is required, because I don't know of any other devices with 8.1, except for the low-powered one. I forget what it's called, Go or something. But basically, the AR stickers is pretty amazing. So those of you with an iPhone may remember an app called, I think it's called Action FX, or Movie Action FX or something, where you go out into the world and you point your camera at, the real world, at a building or street or person or whatever, and you can add effects to it, like a Star Trek starship kind of thing, or explosion effects, or just all kinds of stuff. And it was kind of fun. And a lot of people think that Google's AR stickers is basically that, except nicer. And that's true. Except the amazing thing to me about Google AR stickers is that instead of having a single point of view, and my recollection is you only have a single point of view in Action FX and other AR insertion type things I've seen in the past, is as you're creating the video, you can walk around a virtual object. In fact, you can walk around multiple virtual objects and have different points of view. So you can scatter various objects like a stormtrooper and a pork. Is that how you pronounce it? Porg? Pork? Whatever those little things are.
That's your best guess and mine.
and R2-D2 and so forth into the overlay of the real world. And then you can walk among them and around them and see them from various points of view. So it's pretty darn amazing. The objects do move. The TIE fighters shoot little laser-type things, and stormtrooper moves and so forth. It is amazing. Normally I play with these things once or twice or three or four times, and I'm done. But I cannot stop playing with this. In fact, I've played with it so much that I have not tried at all the other new feature, which is the, what was it called? Oh, yeah, Google Lens, which tells you about things in the world from either the camera app, when you point at it, and or the Photos app for photos you already have there. But anyway, there's that the Google Lens feature that's also baked in, so it's not a separate app as far as I'm aware. Trusted Reviews has a bunch of new, Trusted Reviews lists a bunch of other new features in Oreo 8.1. Number one is something I've been waiting for, and that is if you have a Bluetooth device connected to your phone, you'll be able to see how much power it has in the quick setting shade. This is something iPhone users have had for, I don't know, a long time. When did we not have that? Maybe 8?
Yeah, it's been 9? There for a while.
Yeah. Very, very handy to know how much battery your headset has left or whatever. Also, they added a smart browsing for third-party developers to use for their applications, which is nice because, a lot of a lot of web-based stuff where basically they're launching Chrome and, you don't know what the heck you're seeing. And third, users can instruct their device to disable the fingerprint reader if an unregistered fingerprint is used. Attempted to be used multiple times. That's kind of a nice, safety feature. So that's it with the Oreo stuff. And honestly, the only thing I really care about is the AR stickers.
Well, you're losing many hours of productivity to them, so.
Yeah, Yeah. So I don't need those other features. speaking of losing hours, you know, I don't really catch trains and buses much, although I have, obviously. But one of the things when you catch a train or bus is, you know, you got to be awake at your stop. Because if you miss your stop, you are sometimes in deep trouble. And I don't know, there's been a bunch of times where I said, boy, I wish I could just, you know, catch a quick nap. But you don't want to because, you know, you're going to miss something if you, you know, fall asleep. So Google Maps transit feature now has a new feature that allows you to wake you up at your stop, which I think is pretty darn nice. And I wish I had many, many times in the past.
That would have been very beneficial for me when I was, I used to catch red-eye flights from Seattle to New York about once or twice a year. And I would get off of the plane at JFK. I would make my way to Grand Central Terminal. I would get on a Metro North train to go home. And invariably, I would almost just, I would have to fight to stay awake.
Yeah. I hear you.
About two stops before my stop that I was getting off. I could stay up the whole night on the red-eye flight because I don't really sleep well on planes. But then as soon as we were about 10 miles away from home, everything just started blanking out, and I'd have to, you know, get up and walk around. And
yep.
Yeah.
Okay, now, might be TMI, but did you fall asleep as a kid, as a little kid? Did you fall asleep whenever your parents took you in a car?
I remember falling asleep in a car, but I don't think it was every single time.
Okay. There is something very soothing about riding in a car for some people.
I know that very well, because that happens to my wife whenever we go anywhere that's long distance.
Yeah, and, you know, it's I know my daughter's like that, and it's very frightening to think these people drive, you know? But in any case, anyway, I think it's a pretty cool feature, and I don't know if I'll be taking a train or bus in the near future, but if I do, I, you know, certainly will make use of that new feature. Okay, let's see, more googly stuff. I think it's the last googly item I have. Google updated their flights, trips, and hotel searches on google.com so that it can do things, for example, like show you information on when it's best to book a flight, you know, like when it's optimal. Because, you know, flight prices changes hourly, daily, frequently. You know, if you've ever tried to book a flight, you try one day, look at it, go, too high. Next day, a little bit better. Next day, oh, darn, it went up again. Right? Yep. So this uses historical data to try to help you figure out when to.
It's just like Bitcoin pricing, only it's a real thing.
Yeah, exactly. Well, hey, don't say that to Bitcoin aficionados. Them's fighting words. Also, shifting room rates. So, you know, I'll warn you if there's a conference going on in that area when you were thinking about going to visit someplace. And, you know, hotel rooms get jacked up when they do that. I mean, famously in Las Vegas, where hotel prices are usually amazingly cheap, right, John? I mean, you know, rooms that might be, well, I haven't been there in years, but, you know, back in old days, like doing Comdex and network interop and things like that, hotel room rates, which are normally, I don't know, $75 to $100 a night, would be jacked up to $200 or $300 a night during the conference rates, as they call them. And I remember being horrified at some of the prices and being very glad that my company was paying for it. But otherwise, I would never stay there, you know, 4 or 5 nights at $300 a night, but fortunately, my old company used to do that, so I was able to go to these conferences. But anyway, that's something pretty cool. And, you know, I don't travel as much as I used to, but when I do, this is something I'll definitely take a look at now. Yeah. I mean, sometimes you don't have a choice, and you just got to go, and something's happening, and the price is jacked up. At least you know why it's jacked up. You know, you're not sitting around guessing, like, oh, yeah, Oracle has a conference or something that happened to me once. Okay, let's see. Another item is ZDNet reports that iTunes for the Microsoft App Store will not be available this calendar year. And quite frankly, if you're running a real Windows device, that's not an issue at all, unless for some reason you like Windows Store apps. And I can't think of a reason why you
don't. I don't know anyone who really does.
Yeah. But if you're using Windows 10S, and we have our condolences, I'm sure, you will not have iTunes for your Windows 10S device, including the new Windows on ARM devices, the always connected PCs or whatever they're calling them. So, I didn't, you know, John, I was just thinking about this, though. Is that such a problem? I mean, do you really use iTunes on your desktop much?
Well, I used iTunes on my Windows machine for a very specific purpose, and that was when I played music before class. I would use iTunes for that. But now I'm actually planning on, now that I have a Plex library, doing it that way because it's a lot quicker, and I can just stream it from my home network. So on my Windows machine, I really don't need to use iTunes at all. On my Mac, I use iTunes in two situations.
Yeah.
Whenever I'm manually transferring over ringtones that I've created.
Okay.
And whenever I have an update that got stuck.
Ah.
Occasionally, I have over-the-air updates where you hit install and it just keeps spinning and spinning and spinning and spinning and tells you, try again later. So yeah. I'll have the iTunes update. I'll just use the computer and update the old-fashioned way.
Yeah. The only time I use iTunes on desktop, and that's a Mac, I've never used iTunes on a Windows PC, is when I'm going to do a major update to my phone or tablet. And I feel a little leery. Now, generally speaking, I feel pretty safe about these updates these days. But, you know, before a .0 update, like from a 9 to 10 or whatever, 10 to 11, I'll do a full backup in addition to the backup I do to iCloud. So, yeah, there's that. Okay, so if you're a Windows 10S user, really upgrade to Windows 10, you know, the real one, because that's silly.
That's our advice. Get a real operating system.
Get a horse.
Hippie bum. Yeah, you know.
Okay. Listen, this is the one I wanted your opinion on, John, since I know you're not a social psychologist, but I suspect these things interest you. So Facebook itself reports, and they cite quote-unquote academic research. I really didn't look at their references. You know, too long, didn't read. But they say, and I'm just quoting their title directly, or quoting a paraphrase of them directly. Facebook, citing academic research, says people passively consuming social media feel worse afterwards, while active interaction improves well-being. So my take on this is, this is coming from Facebook. So of course they want you to be more active. You know, okay, maybe I'm just being cynical. You have any thoughts on this, John?
Well, active anything typically is better for you than passive.
Okay.
So, because you're actively processing information.
Here's except for, you know, self-mutilation and things like that.
Yeah, that's true.
But, okay, so basically active is better than passive. I can buy that. I just have real problems when commercial entities issues research about itself. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. You do want to be skeptical of those things, but we'll see how it goes. I can totally get that if you are just sitting there looking at all the awesome things that your friends are doing, that could be really depressing. Right. But actually talking to your friends is where you're probably going to find out, oh, gee, so-and-so's life is, you know, they're struggling the same as I am. And
right.
You get solidarity in that. And, you know, your friends are probably not going to be very flippant with you when you say, oh, I wish I could do that. They're probably not going to say, well, sucks to be you.
Yeah.
They're probably going
Although
to.
Although I have said that.
Well, most people have better friends than you, Todd. So, you know, they're just going to try to be nice about it more so.
I hear what you're saying. And, of course, people want to put their best foot forward on social media. So, in general, not always, but in general, people will try to, you know, focus on the more positive things that they're doing or have had seen or whatever, to be seen in a more positive light. So I can understand that. And, of course, that leads to the whole, you know, passive thing making you feel worse. Because, like you just, you know, mentioned a minute ago, is you see people doing all these quote-unquote awesome things, you say, wow, I'm not doing these awesome things, so what's wrong with me, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay, well, at any rate, so this is a newsroom.fb.com, Facebook's newsroom site. You can take a look at it. Hard questions, spending time, social media bad for us is the URL. Okay, John, you got something down here on Windows 10-ish kind of thing.
Yeah, so news story that kind of came across this week that I thought was interesting. Microsoft apparently has allowed Windows 10 to push out. We know Microsoft loves just slipping things in with Windows 10, including slipping Windows 10 in itself.
Yeah.
In the past, but apparently this is a password manager app that can. That's a free app that Microsoft allows to be pushed out. And if you start using it, you might think, well, this is really helpful, but it's a vulnerable app. It's actually pretty easy to get the passwords out of this app. So the moral of the story here really is, A, Microsoft, please stop installing things without users explicitly saying they want them.
Yeah.
But also, never trust an app that you aren't familiar with. Always vet programs.
Yeah.
Even if it's just on your computer. And if it's, you know, something especially that you're going to be storing secure information with, you want to try to know a little bit more about that. I would never recommend, for example, the two password managers that I think are useful, LastPass and 1Password. I'd never recommend those blindly without someone doing their own homework on if they trusted them or not.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's funny how these things work out, because it's not related to this, but just in terms of security, one of the things I was mentioning to somebody I know at Spectrum, which used to be, depending where you live, either Charter or Time Warner or Bright House. Anyway, they're all combined now into an entity called Spectrum Cable. I was mentioning to somebody over there saying, hey, you know your remote DVR app, you know, the app you have in your iPhone, and you're like standing out at, you know, you're at lunch and you realize, oh, I wanted to, you know, record this show that's going to be on or something. And you pop up the app and you go find the show and you hit record and your DVR records it, right? Simple. Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things I notice is that if I'm on a VPN, it won't work. So I have to turn off the VPN and then launch and then use the app, and then it'll you know, set the TV DVR. And so I mentioned that to him. And the other one I need to mention too, it's a financial institution will not let you log in over a VPN, which to me, which is the utterly stupid. That's exactly the time you want to use a VPN, you know? So, yeah, so if I'm on a VPN, or on a VPN connection, I should say, I can't log into this financial institution. But if I turn off the VPN, boom, I'm in.
Yeah, that is... There's a fundamental misunderstanding of VPNs if they're blocking them. They, for some reason, they think VPNs are used by bad guys to get into good guys' accounts, when in reality, they can also be used by good guys to stay secure from the bad guys.
Right, right. And I should note that in this, I checked to make sure, you know, your VPNs that you get to are not quite random, but they can be in unexpected places, like not in the country you're in. And in all cases, I checked my VPN connection to make sure I was using a US-based VPN server, and you know, not one in, you know, Europe or Asia or someplace. So it's not that it was seeing me as coming in from a different country. It was a US-based server, so I'm not sure what the deal is. Okay, and next up, oh, here's one. This is slightly political, but I'm okay with it. You know, we try not to be too political, but this one's important.
Well, this one's just interesting to me because we've all been inundated with the news about net neutrality and, you know, the viewpoints on both sides. Although, ironically, the viewpoints on the pro-repeal of the rules aren't as loudly talked about.
Most of it came from Russia, as I recall, right?
Well, that's true. And there is you know, the idea that if the FCC were to basically say this is not our business, then the FTC, which has a bit stronger arm in terms of litigiousness, could go after companies for doing anti-consumer practices. So, you know, who knows? I don't really know what to make of this at this point. I wish that we had more firm guidance from those on high about how the net should run. Should we allow these sorts of things or not, regardless of who regulates it?
Right.
Or should we just not regulate it at all?
Right. And violating my own rule about not being too political. I don't think this is too political. But Vinton Cerf, who some would consider the father of the internet, and I know not everyone does, but you know, a lot of, if not the father of the internet, you know, some close relative. As some close and important relatives told the FCC, you don't understand how the internet works.
Now, yeah.
If I said that or you said that, they could, you know, laugh us off and go walk away. But when Vinton Cerf tells you something like that, you really, really should pay attention.
Yeah, I'll agree with that 100%. And I don't think most in the government understand how the internet works.
No.
I don't think that's something that okay, let's put it this way more broadly. Most people don't know how the internet works.
This is true.
So for most people, they don't really understand why a big deal would be about, because most people think of the internet as cable TV. And they sort of think that, you know, someone is controlling, you know, right. There's someone this and that. They don't realize that. I mean, I just told someone this week something about, well, you know, you can buy a domain name for less than $1 promotionally these days. And the whole idea of even owning a .com was completely crazy to them.
Yeah.
That they would have their own.
That's crazy talk.
Yeah, yeah. You don't do that. You know, that's something big, important people do.
Yeah.
And I own like 20 domain names, so I guess I'm really big and really important.
Yeah.
I'm really big, not that important. But one of the things I thought was really interesting is that the list of states and state attorney generals that have signed on to the same suit that was launched really is an interesting list because it transcends political lines. There are red states and blue states on that list.
Yeah.
So if you talk about uniting people against something, you know, the enemy of my friend is my enemy, whatever it is, you know, then, you know, this might have the ways to do that and spur more discussion of what the internet is and how it should or should not be regulated.
Yeah. And I think one of the reasons why it may be a nonpartisan issue, let me rephrase it. It may be nonpartisan at the state and local level. It certainly is partisan at the federal level. It may be nonpartisan at the state and local level because it's going to hit states where it hurts. That's their tax collection. So if small businesses are not ramping up and becoming bigger businesses, and bigger businesses are not making money or as much money as they should because they're getting throttled or having transit problems between carriers, then they're not going to be collecting taxes because those companies are not going to be making more money. And so it is in the best interest of the pocketbook, whether it's red or blue, for state and local governments to pay attention to how it affects them at the, you know, at the very local level of the businesses that pays taxes to them. And generates other income that, you know, helps people around them, that, again, basically helps generate taxes for them. You know, it's like Google's an ad company, right? State and local governments are tax machines. That's what they do. That is how they make money. So, yep, hopefully they will be paying attention to that. I wonder if John froze.
No, I'm here.
Okay. So, and speaking of freezing, how's that for a segue? So the Apple Heart Study, I got in. You're not in yet, apparently?
Yeah, I'm not in. Maybe they don't like my heart as much as they like yours.
Well, I got in last night. I got my notification late last night. I want to say about 10 p.m., I think. And just to let you know what happens, John. So what happens is you'll get a notification, and it'll say, hey, join up so you can, you know, start in the study, blah, blah, blah. And it makes it sound like it's urgent, by the way. So I don't know if there's a time limit to this study or what. You know, that kind of makes sense, right? You don't want studies to go on forever. You need to freeze it and draw data sometimes. But anyway, what happens is you answer a bunch of questions after you get in. It asks you, you know, have you ever had a, you know, like a heart attack? Or do you have this? Do you take this medication or that medication? So it asks you a bunch of really personal questions. But, you know, that's kind of the name of the game in this case. So it's not a big deal, in my opinion. And then, you know, ask you permission to share that data and so forth. And then you're in. And then, I don't have my iPhone with me. I have my Pixel 2 with me at the moment. But then, basically, all it says to you is you are now in day one of the study.
Interesting.
Yeah, it doesn't actually show you data.
Well, yeah. That doesn't really surprise me too much.
Yeah. I mean, like, your own data, right?
So. Well, presumably, if you know your own data, you might take steps to change your data.
Ah, okay.
You might say, gee, my heart rate was really up yesterday. Maybe I should, you know, do something.
It's not heart rate. It's heart irregularity.
Well,
yeah.
There's still ways that you could. I mean, you could decide to just all of a sudden become Zen Buddhist or something.
Yeah.
You know, focus more and you know, there are ways that you can affect these things physiologically. So yeah. Okay. I can understand them not providing
so data. Just anyway, that's a preview to you when you get accepted. They'll just ask you a bunch of questions and they'll say, you know, thank you for participating, blah, blah, blah. And you'll get a little screen that says you're in day one of the study. You know, speaking of, you know, kind of a Zen approach to things, I'll tell you a I guess it's kind of a technical story. So I'm in an office building with really finicky elevators. It's only got two elevators and they're both finicky. One elevator goes to kind of random floors. And by random, I mean not the floor you chose and not a floor that somebody else is waiting on. So you might press, you might be on floor one and you want to go up to floor five. It might go to the basement, even though there's nobody there in the basement waiting for it. And you could say, well, maybe the other person caught the elevator. I don't think so. And then you go up. And again, you know, you have not pressed any buttons yet. And they'll stop on floor four. I press five, right? Nobody's on four. And then it'll meander up to five. Okay, that's one elevator, the random elevator. The other haunted elevator, as we've come to refer to these elevators, has doors that will not close for, gee, did I time it? I think it was about 22 seconds. And you say, well, 22 seconds isn't very long. 22 seconds is an eternity when you're watching an open elevator door and just waiting for it to close. And so I decided instead of getting annoyed and angry, I would use it as a time to practice some quick meditation techniques. Mm-hmm. And so I sort of, you know, straightened up, get a nice posture, take a deep breath, kind of, you know, just a cleansing breath, as I guess some of the practitioners might call it, and just sort of close my eyes for a second, and then the door will close, you know, eventually. So instead of using it as a moment for anger and frustration, I've tried to use it as a moment for meditation and relaxation, since there's nothing I can do about this haunted elevator and when its doors will close, including pressing the close button. That doesn't work either, by the way.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, you know, helping people accept the things they cannot change.
That's right.
That's what life does many times.
You know, and I've often wondered about this. You know, you've probably read the articles that say that when you're in a, let's say, a hotel room or an office and there's a temperature control on the wall, that many of these don't actually work. You know, the fan may work, you know, like, you know, not the fan, like ceiling fan, but, you know, the air conditioning vent, you may be able to affect that for more or less. But the actual temperature is centrally controlled, and they are not going to let you raise it and lower it. Now, I've seen this is not true for all rooms. I've felt warmer when I've, at least I think I felt warmer. I don't carry a thermometer with me. But it is noticeably warmer when, you know, when I press something to be warmer, or if it's too hot, you know, press it cooler. But apparently some of these things don't work. I often wonder if also pedestrian crosswalks. Pressing the button doesn't do anything but make you feel like you have some control. Doesn't actually change if the light's going to, you know, go from green to red faster to let you cross the street. But anyway, I often wondered about that.
Well, now that you've just made everyone sad by ruining the illusions of the world that we have. But, I guess all I can say is have fun with your meditation and your crazy elevators.
I know, right? But, you know, instead of making my heart rate go up, I'm trying to make it, well, you know, maybe not go down, but at least remain stable during these random door openings and random floor stops and whatever the heck is going on. And everybody's complaining about it, by the way. It's not just me imagining this. Everybody talks about this in the office. And, of course, nothing is being done, even though we reported to building management and things like that.
Well, I mean, you work for the government. What do you want?
Indeed.
Yeah, it won't change.
No.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. Working for a state government in any level is never going to... You're not going to see any difference.
No.
The last thing I had today, which is an interesting discussion for difference because I think it's a broader discussion.
Okay.
Snapchat recently announced their new user numbers that weren't very high for a company like Snapchat. They've only 4.5 million new users in the last quarter. You know, I'd be happy to have 4.5 million users, anything. But the interesting thought that some have is that it's because while iOS has a good user base, Android does have more users.
Right.
And the Android app for Snapchat is basically treated almost like a second-class citizen. It doesn't get features as fast. It doesn't have as many bells and whistles. It's not as polished as the iOS app. And it leads me to wonder, this has been a question I think that we've wondered about for a while, but it hasn't come up recently, if this is something companies should be concerned about, because the prevailing wisdom has long been that iOS users are more lucrative than Android users.
Yeah, that's true.
Buy more. But for a company like Snapchat, where you're not necessarily selling anything, but you are getting ad revenue and you're getting promotional revenue, things like that, you want more users. You don't really care if those users are buying things from you. So should you really still prioritize iOS users?
Well, I know it happens as a person who uses both iPhone and Android devices. Certainly the app situation on my Android is far less rich than the iOS. But should you? I think no. You know, if you're a big, well, let me rephrase that. If you are a big company with thousands and thousands of employees, like presumably Snapchat is these days, why? Right? You should, you know, support the big two or big three if there is a third one. I don't guess we don't have a third operating system anymore.
You mean Windows Phone isn't a third operating system?
Or BlackBerry?
yeah, I guess you're right, you know.
Which is closing its World App Store in 2019, by the way, so. Mm. And I think their Playbook video chat thing is shutting down next year. But, yeah, it does seem like a silly thing to do or not do. But that said, here's a question for you, since I didn't use Snapchat at all. Is Snapchat still skewing towards younger users, like in the teens and early 20s, or has it started being like Facebook is skewing up?
My guess would be that it's still skewing there.
Okay, so the other possibility is that we have a shift in population again, you know, like during the baby boom and the, you know, when we had a sudden influx of, but an influx, a larger than normal influx of people of a, you know, age cohort emerging. Are we seeing just basically, at least in the developed nations, which presumably is where Snapchat is has most of its users, seeing just basically fewer young people emerge in the prime age group, you know, aging into the system and older users aging out of the system?
That is something that you could make the argument for, and I think is not necessarily a bad argument to make. Although Snapchat, I do think, has made strides in the last few years to try to appeal to a larger age group.
Yeah.
But still, it does skew primarily toward people who are in the 14 to 21 range.
And the other thing would be interesting is if somebody would do you know, some kind of research in how it and Twitter might be related. Because one of Twitter's problems is it's simply not growing very fast.
Mm-hmm.
And it is not age skewed, in my opinion, at least. Well, maybe it is. Actually, it's age skewed older. You probably age into it older than you do on Snapchat. But, you know, Twitter has some real growth problems. And probably the only thing keeping it alive is people want to know what our president is doing.
Yeah, that's the thing that Twitter has going for it more than any other social network, is that Twitter is the social network of record, in a sense.
Yeah, it is. I strongly think that. I mean, it's not just, you know, political figures, but, you know, CEOs of companies that people are familiar with are on there. Even Tim Cook tweets every now and then. Not often, but I think he's had 7 tweets in his life. But, you know, that's where you go to find news. I know when something's happening, I'll often go to Twitter first, because it'll hit Twitter before it hits CNN and, you know, Fox or whoever, whichever flavor of news you prefer. Or if, you know, I feel an earthquake or something, or, you know, wonder what traffic is like, I'll go to Twitter for those things. Because goodness knows, terrestrial radio is useless for local news.
Very true.
Yeah. And what else is there, right? TV stations? No. Radio? Well, you know, basically nothing except Twitter. It's kind of scary. Yeah. And that's, and you know, with some of the changes in the ownership of media entities, you know, it's going to be harder and harder to get hyper-local news because, you know, things are consolidated into basically robo-news, centralized robo-news sites with no actual local boots-on-the-ground type employees for these media outlets. But at any rate, as we come to the end, I think this is our last podcast of the calendar year, John.
Yeah, I believe it is.
Yeah. So I wanted to thank you once again for hanging in there and being such a reliable and stable co-host for years now. How long have we been doing this? A couple of years now, I think.
We started doing this in December of 2013.
Yeah, so it's been a while. And I know it's a hit on your time, and you make, for me, it's not too bad. I should note that John and I are several time zones apart. So, you know, for John, it's either the middle of the day or kind of, well, not middle of the night, but evening. And so, you know, he gives that time up to just hang out with me for our fives of listeners.
Yeah. Hang out with our fives of listeners.
Yeah, exactly. We should have a whole, we should do a podcast where everybody who's ever listened, that'd be funny. But anyway, thank you, John. Really appreciate your time. Really appreciate your knowledge and everything. And, I don't know if I'm going to do another podcast before the end of the year. I might ask some other friends to join me if they have time, but this is a hard time of the year to get people to, you know, do anything except eat and drink and open presents and stuff like that. So, and, you know, a lot of people are traveling, not me, fortunately. But anyway, thanks again. And if I don't see you until next year, Happy New Year, John.
Thank you.
And a politically incorrect Merry Christmas.
May all of the festivities and celebrations that you may or may not engage in over the next 2 to 3 to 8 weeks be as joyous and or as somber as you would deem culturally appropriate.
Right. And don't forget Festivus, December 23rd, yes, as I recall, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, decorate the Festivus pole and there you go. You'll be happy. Mm-hmm. You'll be happy if you do that, if you have a Festivus poll and you're active on Facebook. I think that's the way the world works. Okay, very folks. That is Movies Podcast 235. The last one John and I will record for this calendar year. We will see you next year. And I may be back with a mini podcast or something, but if not, I will see you next year. Or hear, you will hear us next year. I won't actually see you, but you know how that works. We'll talk to you. Bye.